Welcome to another episode of Wish I Knew, a podcast where I speak with people about their careers, focusing on their success, advice, mentoring, and listening to their really interesting stories. I'm your host, Gary Nowak. And when this guest agreed to be on my podcast, I felt grateful and intimidated all at the same time. Dr. Catherine Downing has helped me a great deal with my future of being an executive coach. A little bit about her background. She's a lawyer by trade, entered the publishing industry, and became the publisher, president, and CEO of the LA Times, board member for the Women's Foundation of California, founder of Executive to Executive, where she began her coaching career, coach and supervisor with the Hudson Institute of Coaching, program leader for Coaching Supervision Academy, and she recently received her doctorate in professional studies, coaching supervision from Middlesex University in London. Some highlights from our conversation: cleaning hotel rooms at age 15, working for a very demanding boss, the impact of cleaning rooms that sticks with her today, being financially independent and how important that was to her, becoming a lawyer, then 18 months later, coming to a realization, law school and having to work full time, hitting a sales cap mid-year, then going to product development, moving to Dayton and loving it, CEO of traditional print companies being a great role, professional publishing for three different companies, being a CEO and listening to everyone in the company, getting the "who the hell are you" comments, San Diego snowy comment gets unwanted traction, interesting perspective on taking ownership, shipping physical records out of a state to keep them safe during some troubling times while she was in LA, the most hate mail she ever received at the LA Times, 8 years of trying to figure out what was next, working with Brené Brown and Deepak Chopra early on, finding focus on a beach in North Carolina, great Keystone speaking discussion, best mentors were horrible bosses and books, fast decision making, the impact of being a woman. Okay, I know I've talked too much. Let me get out of your way so you can enjoy my conversation with Dr. Catherine Downing. Catherine, I don't have a bucket list of guests. However, when I invited you on the podcast and you said yes, I was thrown off my chair. So I've been looking forward to this one for a while. So thank you so much for being on with me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Gary. It's such a delight to be here. I too have been looking forward to it. And it provided me this great reflective moments just to think about your questions. So thanks.
So we're almost done then. So you're going to be one of the most buttoned up guests I've ever had, because the majority of my guests, are you ready? Do you have any questions? No, I haven't even read the questions. Let's just roll with it. So you're a prepared guest, which I'm sure it'll come through in spades.
But I hope not buttoned up. I'd like to be a little lighter than that.
Well, I'll do my best to tear it apart. Tell me about your very first job.
My very first job was when I was 15 years old in a little strip motel across from the Portland Coliseum where the hockey games were played and the basketball was played. And I was cleaning rooms.
At 15?
At 15, yep. After school and on weekends.
And this is Portland, Oregon?
It is.
Is that where you grew up?
Yep, born and raised.
What got you that job? What drove that?
My mom owned the motel.
There you go.
She wanted me to have a really good work ethic. And I think she had no idea how pivotal that would not, I didn't either at the time, but how pivotal that experience was for me as a human.
What was pivotal about it?
I was a successful student, a successful member of my community, responsible young adult with my younger siblings. And so I was treated well.
Mm-hmm.
Doted on, really, by my teachers. And when I was cleaning rooms, best case, people didn't see me when I walked by rolling the cart. Worst case, they sneered at me. They said something rude. Worst case, they trashed their rooms, expecting somebody to come in and pick up all sorts of things I had never seen or knew of at 15. And so for me, that just invisibility and tremendous disrespect brought home to me, it isn't what we're doing in the world. It's the fact that we're alive and human. That's why we should respect each other.
Did you have that deep thought at 15, or is this
No, I knew at the time that I would never treat anyone the way they were treating me. I knew it in my core that it was unfair, but I've seen it play out over and over and over in my life. It's just who I am in terms of respecting everyone.
That's what you've seen play out is your reaction to people. So you've seen people maybe not trash the room, but trash a meeting or trash another person. And that message, that lesson you learned at 15 always stuck with you by cleaning rooms, seeing what people do. And I'm sure they were embarrassed to see the cleaning person going by because they're like, oh, if they knew I walked out of that room and they saw what a mess it was, there's probably a sense of shame, I would imagine.
I don't think so. But we'll never know because we don't get to interview them.
That's right. Unless I do the podcast on, have you ever trashed a room? I want to talk to you.
Yeah. And find out how much entitlement there is in that.
People think they have a right. Okay. This is a big question for you is like, how do you want to walk through your career? Because you know, there's a lot of educational background. You've almost had a very long career with great work that you've done. So how do you want to start?
Let me start here. My mom was a mom of five and in a very crappy marriage. And my favorite aunt was a mom of five and a very crappy marriage. And watching that as a preteen and teen, what I knew, I was always going to be financially independent. I was always going to be financially self-sufficient. So my career started with that seed and that determination. And then it got derailed a couple of times because I was female and this was the late 60s, early 70s. So I went to law school because my favorite aunt had gone to law school in the 60s as a mom of five so that she could become a single mom of five and support her family. And 18 months into practice, I loved law school. 18 months into practice, I woke up one morning and I didn't want to go to work. And I went, oh, crap. It isn't just about financial sufficiency. I have to love what I do. And that passion for being in service in a variety of ways in publishing is what moved me from the practice of law to legal publishing.
And why was financial independence so important for you? Because of what you saw with your mom and your aunt?
Exactly.
And they were, what's the right word? They were stuck, for lack of a better word, in a situation that they didn't want to be in?
Yes, and didn't have the financial wherewithal to get out. My aunt got there by going to law school, and my mom got there eventually by her own entrepreneurship.
So you jumped into law because your aunt, and you saw maybe a financial path that way. Then, so you go to law school for all that time. That's a major commitment. Then you're practicing for 18 months, and you wake up and think, I'm not happy.
Yep.
Then what happened?
I called when I was in law school, my first year, I had a full scholarship at Columbia. And then I transferred to Stanford and got no scholarship. So I had to work full time while I went to second, third years of law school. So I worked for a emerging online service, something never heard of before, because this was way before the internet. Called what is now called LexisNexis. And they were training lawyers how to use an online research service. And the lawyers only wanted to be trained nights and weekends. And in 77, they were paying $20 an hour, which you couldn't get anywhere. So every evening and all weekend, so that I'd get about 40 hours a week, I trained. And that let me pay my way through law school.
Wow. Just so you know, mentioning Columbia and Stanford, you're not really, and being a lawyer, you're not allowed to use big words on this podcast, okay?
Yeah, make no you, worries.
So keep it simple for me, okay? Don't go flying over my head. I don't want to be embarrassed by my great guest with the handful of listeners that might be tuning in for this one.
Gary, you so, are really funny.
You're funny looking. You go there, you go to Stanford. LexisNexis, I remember that. I remember I was at Anderson in the mid-90s, and that was the way to get news and information and things. And it was like, huh, yeah, it was a big deal. You go through that, you get out law school, 18 months, LexisNexis, then how did you determine what you wanted to do? So you wake up and say, hey, I don't want to be a lawyer. I'm not happy. Ooh, what's going through your mind?
I loved working with lawyers. in learning the system. I just love the training aspect of it, the being in service to them of a whole new way of doing research, of how they approach their cases and client work. And I'd been a lawyer, so I knew even more about it. So I called them back up and said, hey, will you take me back? And they said, sure. So I went back as a training manager and then a sales rep. And another really good lifelong lesson. The year I became a sales rep, the CEO had been upset that the prior year, some of the sales reps had made more money than he had because of the compensation plan and sales were going well. So he capped the commission plan for that year. And I hit the cap mid-year. And I said, you got to be kidding me. What am I going to do now? And my sales boss said, nothing, I guess, because we're not going to pay you.
Take 6 months off.
And so rather than take 6 months off, I said, oh, great. Well, why don't I come to headquarters and do product development? Because I know a lot about our customers. Why don't I come do product development? And you can pay me a whole lot less because I won't be in the sales force. So I moved from San Francisco to Dayton, of course, a very easy move.
And Dayton, Ohio.
Took a cut in pay and was happy as could be. But that's how I got into publishing.
What's a sales rep in a law firm do? They go, you go business development, look for clients?
No. So a sales rep for LexisNexis. So I went to law firms and said, oh, and government agencies and anybody who had lawyers and said, oh, you need this.
I got you. So you must have been great at sales.
I was good at sales. I did very well at sales, but it's not my cup of tea.
No?
So I was happy to go to Dayton.
But one could say you're doing sales in your current profession, which I'm sure we're going to get to at some point in this podcast. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Imagine that. That's a good... That's an interesting question. I don't think I do sales. All my business is referral.
Then that's a good salesperson.
Yeah.
You don't think you do, but every conversation you have, you're selling in some form or fashion. I'm getting the shoulder nod and the head tilted sideways right now, just for those listeners that are out there that know this isn't on video. So that's what I'm seeing in front of me. So you're a great salesperson. You go to Dayton and you made a comment like you're as happy as you could be. Why is that?
Because when you're in the field as a sales rep talking to prospective customers, they're really good at pointing out to you what data is missing, what else they need in the service. So I went to product development to help identify, license, and build databases for those customers. And I was excited about it.
So you're helping solve problems.
Yeah, in service.
What skill set did you have there that made you good at that? Why you liked it? Because if you're happy, you must be pretty good at it.
Yeah, customer knowledge, ability to prioritize, ability to make decisions and get funding, and ability to execute.
You were prepared for that question, I think.
Actually, did it? Well, maybe I am because that's who I am, right? In many respects.
Yeah. I like it. So customer knowledge, prioritize, all great skill sets. And the third one was product development.
Make decisions.
So people can prioritize, but if they don't make decisions, it's useless.
Yeah.
And what was the final one? I can't remember.
Execute.
One of the worst podcasts those ever. Okay. So you did all that stuff. You're in Dayton. How was Dayton compared to Portland? And I think you said San Francisco, right?
I've lived, I don't know now, maybe 17 places in my career and life. And no matter where I've been, there have been really good people and lovely communities and neighborhoods. And now that I have the choice of where I live in a beach town because I am such a water ocean person. But Dayton's a big jump from San Francisco and before that Sacramento and before that, right, this long list. But it was fine. It was good. Nice people, good work.
I'm from Detroit. Did you notice the good-natured people in the Midwest? This is a leading question, by the way.
Well, of course. Of course. They are the nicest humans.
You're not just saying that, are you?
No. And just remember, I have 7 grandkids and 2 sons and a daughter-in-law in Cincinnati. So I still have deep Midwest roots.
There you go. It is a good part of the world. And I've always noticed people that have grown up in the Midwest that I've met elsewhere. They do it very basic stuff. If they say they're going to be there, they're going to be there. They do what they say and say what they do. So how good is that? Where are we now? So we're in Dayton, you're happy, you've got these four things that you're doing really well. And these are the great traits that made you a good product development for LexisNexis. So you're doing that. And when you left San Francisco, you gave that up because you were at the 6 month where you couldn't make any more money. And you said, fine, send me to Dayton and you'll do product development. So was that the same company? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Then what happened? 6 months later, you go back and start selling or?
Well, so no, I stayed. So the fast version, and then we can dig into where you want, is I was really good at product development. I had a lot to learn about being a manager at that point. And ultimately, I left to do a startup electronic publishing company for a big publisher, and then became CEO of one of their traditional print companies. And that kicked off the whole segment of my career that was working with traditional print operations and turning them from, we write this, we create this, we print a book, to we write this, we create this, we publish it in any format that our customers want. So moving from print companies to information companies, and that became my specialty. So I stayed in professional publishing for a number of years, three different companies, until I went to the LA Times to do something similar there.
And you said CEO. How was that role?
Great role. It's just a great role.
To be at the top of the mountain.
And well, it's a very interesting place because in some respects you're isolated. How do you cultivate and get real feedback? And it requires a great determination and drive to results. And for me, it required a connection with the people in the organizations. And a lot of really, because we were, the whole publishing industry was in this huge transition in those years. And it took a lot of innovation in the context of where we were competitively at the strategic level. And so complexity, great learning curve for me, ability to work with my teams, and ability to drive culture change and results.
So you mentioned one thing, connections. How did you build those?
Well, for me, I met and listened to everyone in the company. And when I went for my first CEO role, which was in Rochester, New York, I'd go out to the printing plant or I'd be in the halls of the main downtown buildings. And I'd stop and I'd talk to people. And person after person after person after person said to me, I've worked here 25 years, 30 years, 45 years. I've never met the CEO. That doesn't work for me. I need to know and hear and listen and be with and engage with. And I learned it the hard way in Rochester because I went in and met with, I had an idea of what we needed to do strategically, pretty firm idea, met with my senior team. We ironed it out and then we rolled it across the company. And of course, the immediate reaction was, who the hell are you? And, oh, you want to talk to us, but you don't want to listen to us. You don't want our involvement. And it was one of those beautiful life lessons of, oh yeah, we're going to do this again. And we did. We did a whole process, ground up, top down, and found our way to a new imagined future. And it was great.
So when you were in Rochester walking around talking to people that have never met the CEO, what did you talk about?
Whatever was on their mind. And sometimes they asked me questions about what we're doing and what we're up to and the threat of electronic publishing versus the print plant. And sometimes they talked about their families or their friends or their history with the organization or what was going on at the Music Center or something like that. So it was wide ranging. The only time I made a lot of mistakes, but this was a really crucial relationship issue, was I was walking in one snowy day with the security guard from the parking lot. And we just happened to be coming in at the same time. And I was dusting the snow off my coat and taking my gloves off and all that. And I said to him, oh, wouldn't it be great if we were headquartered in San Diego? And I just said it lightly. I was kidding. We'd been there 125 years. We weren't going anywhere. And within 20 minutes, the phone in my office was ringing off the hook, right? Pre-cell phones. We're moving headquarters.
Ruh-roh.
It was a good reminder that the CEO always has the stripes on the shoulders, and you have to pay attention to every single word in every single context.
So you brought something I want to talk about. Any, you know, setbacks in your career that were very impactful at the time that turned out to be great?
Well, great's an interesting word. What if I said impactful and really contributed to my personal and professional growth? They could be phrased as good in that context, but good in the sense of hurting other people, no, I wouldn't put any of them as good. But yeah, of course. One was, there was this big controversy when I was at the LA Times. And I really went into a lot of shame and self-recrimination as a result of it. And it took me probably, 8 to 10 years to process it fully and understand what it had to offer. To be excoriated in the press as a member of the press for things that felt so inappropriate, unfair, gender-based, bunch of stuff, was really hard. And so I don't think anything great or good came out of it. Obviously, we came through it as a paper and I stayed as publisher and we all learned a lot. But did anything great come out of that? No, I don't think so. Except I learned a whole bunch, as we all did.
What was your biggest learning?
Well, this will sound odd, I think, but my biggest personal learning is that my experiences as a child drove some actions in a moment that had wide implications. So as a child, I scooped up my younger siblings and got them out of the house to keep them safe. So when the controversy started at the paper, I was publisher, I said, I'm going to take full responsibility for this. That's scooping everybody up and keeping them safe. Instead of letting us really sort through it, evaluate it, talk about it, and see who each had a piece of the puzzle and what to do with all those multiple pieces of the puzzle. And I think as an organization, we would have come through it with a lot of learning, how we work together, how we work across the business side and the newspaper side, what we wanted to do, how to frame it. And by my taking full responsibility, it was sort of letting everybody else off the hook for looking at themselves and their role. And so what the paper learned is they could be really angry at a publisher, as opposed to the number of lessons we might have learned.
Interesting. I like the parallel back to your childhood. And if I could just get back, because I thought I warned you not to use big words like recrimination and excoriated. So that's your second warning to not use big words, because I'm going to have to go look those up. I can, in context, I think I can figure out what it is, but I'm not too sure. So what's it like working for publishing? I just have this vision of nonstop, 24/7, always making decisions. What was it like?
Newspapers, absolutely. Professional publishing, no, because you had a long schedule, you had a long publishing cycle, you worked with the authors. So a lot of pressure to be responsive to customers, to, you know, meet the business results, to go through the cultural shift, which is a big shift to go from being a book publisher to being an information provider and creator. Newspaper, yeah, it's great. 24/7, it was just great.
You love that.
I do, yeah. Yeah.
Any stories, any one story that broke or anything that comes to your mind is like, boy, I remember when this happened, it was epic.
Well, it's interesting. There was an investigative reporting that we were doing, and we were quite concerned about keeping the integrity of our records intact and our notes. And we were quite concerned about how we might do that. So we actually, before we ran the story, we shipped all of our records out of state just to keep them secure and confidential.
Because it's all physical records.
Yeah, comes to mind. Yeah. They were all physical in those days. Yeah. But the other thing that was really fascinating to me, we got very involved at a community level in helping the schools with reading volunteers in first, second, third grade, because we had done some investigative reporting and sharing that kids learn to read first through third or kindergarten through third, and then they read to learn. So if they weren't reading at grade level by third grade, they weren't going to make it. It was going to be much harder for them. And our goal was to put 10,000 volunteers in the schools, and many of us were reading in the schools, which was just beautiful and fabulous. And we ran a front page editorial, which we seldom did, but we ran a front page editorial saying, because at that point, LA Unified School District was not making very good numbers in terms of kids finishing third grade who could read. And we said, we ought to put a stake in the ground and say maybe 100% of the kids should be able to read. Life skill, important. And we, in my time as publisher, we got more hate mail for that editorial than anything we wrote about. People, and it ran the gamut of people who had a stake and an interest in this editorial, saying, you're setting us all up for failure, you're setting false expectations, it's not possible, you're dreaming, it's more complicated than the school system. And we said, yeah, but we think, yeah, we ought to do it. But that was such a surprise for me.
These were people that basically you were putting on point to say, we need 100%. So these are your educators.
It was across the board readership. People had all sorts of stakes in it.
Wow. And whose decision was it? Well, I think the volunteering is amazing. Whose decision was it to do that?
To run the editorial or to do the volunteer and focus on the schools?
The volunteering and the editorial.
We had a sister paper, the Baltimore Sun, and they had started it about 6 months before as a community effort. And we watched it and we looked. That took us to look at LA Unified School District and the percentage of achievement and what was happening in the schools more in depth. And so we got motivated and we decided. It was an effort between the business side and the news side. And ultimately, as publisher, I, of course, said yes. But
what was the result?
Long term, I think we had impact, but I don't think LA Unified is... I don't know what their current statistics are. It's hard. It's hard. There are a lot of factors. I get it.
Yeah. And we're, you know, a first world country and people need to read, but it's great that there was awareness there. Okay. LA Times, what happened next for you? Or where do you want to go next?
Yeah. LA Times got acquired by the Chicago Tribune. Great, great deal. Brilliant timing. Very successful for the shareholders. And it was pretty hostile to management, current management.
At the LA Times.
Yeah. Well, across the many papers and companies that the parent Times Mirror owned at that point. So a number of us left by invitation. We were terminated. And it was such an interesting time for me because I'd had this great series of careers in corporate and publicly traded companies, family controlled in most situations. And I didn't know what, and I thought I'd be at the LA Times till I retired about this time in my life. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I literally didn't know. So I did a bunch of different things. I did a startup with Deepak Chopra and his daughter. I did large scale urban school reform for 3 years. I renovated a house. I just sort of was trying to figure out what to do. Did a lot of work during that time for the Women's Foundation of California because one of my through lines is empowering women and girls. And so that was really good work. And then I was just walking with a dear friend in North Carolina who happened to work with me at the LA Times. And she said, I just don't understand why you never went into executive coaching. Look at all we did in executive leadership development and look at how many coaches you hired for members of your organizations. I said, Elizabeth, I'd never thought about it. And 24 hours later, I was searching for the right certification program to become an executive coach.
And how long was that period where you were just trying everything?
8 years.
Then one conversation on a beach in North Carolina saying, huh. And it all, in your mind, what happened?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, Gary. In my mind, what happened? I can tell you physically what happened. Her statement filled me, my whole body vibrated. It filled me with such resonance that yes, take my focus on women and girls, take my executive experience. Here's another way to be in service. So what happened is I had to do it, wanted to do it, couldn't wait to do it.
That's the vehicle. Which coaching program did you land on?
I went to Hudson Institute of Coaching.
I've heard of it.
So it was sort of an interesting start because when I came home from that trip and I started looking at certification schools, I thought, well, I won't go to Hudson. They must be local because I lived in Santa Barbara and they were in Santa Barbara. And then I went and did my due diligence. And of course, Hudson was the top of so many lists. I thought, oh my God, I'm living in the backyard of one of the best institutes in the world for learning how to be an executive coach.
And you don't have to move. And they're right there.
Or travel or anything. Just get up and go. Yeah, it was great.
And Hudson's pretty much on the forefront of working with the ICF and certification programs. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Yes. And with the adoption of what's called supervision and coaching, which is reflective practice, they're the only institute in North America that has a supervision center. So they continue to be at the forefront.
Yep. Okay. So you have this epiphany, everything comes together. You gave me a somatic, maybe I'm throwing a big word in there, of how it felt for you versus what your mind was going through. So you get in with Hudson and this kind of kicks into the executive coaching career. So take me from there. How did training go? How did you build up your practice? Did you have a niche? What was the perspective there?
Well, so the training was really interesting because I thought I was going to learn how to be a coach. And 80% of my experiences were because we're this instrument in our work. I say we because you're a coach. Since we're the instrument in our work, 80% of my learning at Hudson was about myself. And I went, oh, but I had a lot of delight and joy in that as well as some scary discoveries. But one of the things I most learned from my mom was the importance of feedback, to be always in a learning, feedback-rich environment. My stepfather, who was a beloved parent for me, was a lifelong learner. And so to be now in this intensive program, looking at myself was just energizing and discouraging at some points, but energizing. And so it was great. It was just great.
Well, that's why I chose Hudson, is because there was this massive self-reflection, which I thought, okay, if I don't learn anything else, at least I can reflect on myself. And then obviously, as you go through the program, you're the most important instrument in coaching. I want to talk about feedback for a second, because you said the importance of feedback. What's your perspective on advising people to get feedback, or how people can get feedback from people? What can put them in more of a comfortable mode on getting feedback?
So in my experience, it takes consistent cultivation to have people be willing to give you feedback. And it takes an openness to sit with what they've given. You don't have to take all of it, but the ability to listen and say, tell me more. Can you give me an example of that? I really want to understand this. So that we can then reflect ourselves and decide what's a way we want to be, even though it has that kind of impact on someone, what's a way that we might want to alter that. But I think it's as much about our cultivation of people to give us feedback and appreciating it, even if we don't take it, and not getting defensive. So for me, it's our own art. And then people will give it to you in the way they can. And sometimes it's awkward and sometimes it's not, but then they're willing to share with you their experiences.
Well, you said something that's important, is creating the openness and that trust. But also what I gleaned out of that was your interpretation of the feedback or how you react to it. Because if you get defensive when you're getting feedback, that's not going to play well. You're not going to get out of it what you need to. And my view on feedback, when you ask for it, you're almost opening that door to somebody to say, yes, I'm ready to hear something that may be constructive, that may be unpleasant for me to hear. It's as much as your mindset asking for the feedback and preparing yourself, bracing yourself for maybe something you don't want to hear. But it takes time. It just takes that relationship, that consistent cultivation, I think you called it, right?
Yes. And I would say it also takes a filter to really sit with, am I pushing this away because it's not valid for me? Or am I pushing this away because it's too hard to look at? Or I don't like the way it was delivered. But I'll give you sort of a stark example. I was doing a keynote in my corporate years on mergers and acquisitions and using as a case study a company that we had acquired and shifted from a full publishing company to an editorial operation. So we closed the printing plant. We let a lot of production people go, but we did it in a way that really celebrated them and their contribution. And so I was giving a keynote on this. At the end of the keynote, I was milling around. People had a few questions for me. And this guy, older guy, I would have said old until I hit my 60s, but an older guy now in my frame of reference.
Young buck.
Came up to me and he was pointing his finger sort of at my chest and saying, listen, you shouldn't have the title of CEO. You no more sounded like a CEO than I don't know what. What you sounded like was a sociologist and you should be ashamed of yourself. Now there's feedback, right? There's feedback.
That's feedback.
And I really thought about it. What was it that I had said that was so triggering for him? And what I concluded was that, yes, in my presence, in my way being of corporate, I drove results, but I did it hand in hand with respectful working relationships with the people in the companies. And what he couldn't hold, what he couldn't see, is you could have both. And so I sort of savored it. I love being called a sociologist in that context, because for me, it's not a denigration. He meant it that way. But for me, it was, oh yeah, so I did communicate that you can be respectful, humble, appropriate in relationship and make hard, tough business decisions.
And he was a top-down guy. That's the only way to manage.
He was something, yeah. Yeah.
Any mentors in your life that have been impactful?
Yes, it's such a fascinating question for me, because where I go immediately is my best mentors were, I'm going to slightly overstate, horrible bosses of mine, because I learned so much from what they did that I would never be like that. It was rich with a lot of pain and discomfort, but it was rich with learning about, oh, I see the impact of that behavior, that approach, that decision-making process, and I'm going to do it differently when I'm in charge. The second piece of mentoring for me is I've found books along the way that have given me a landing pad, if you will, for who and how I am as a CEO that I couldn't find from my colleagues in the moments or in the months or years. So for example, early in my career, I was in these rooms full of white guys saying, take the hill, win the battle, bring out the cannons, whatever. And I found a book by a guy named Bob Autry, who was a senior executive at Meredith Publishing, called Love and Profit. And he wrote about this embodied experience of a respectful, collaborative work environment. And then I found right after that, The Female Advantage by Helgeson, where she talked about how differently women manage, how we connect spider webs as opposed to hierarchy. And both of those books gave me such confidence to trust myself, to trust my intuition in leadership and management, not try to emulate the guys. So mentors from bad bosses, mentorship from authors who really touched something deep in me, and then a handful of really good mentors. One of my bosses who gave me my first CEO job, just he always said to me, it's about fast decision making. He said, I might make 13 decisions and 9 of them are good in the same time that somebody else makes 6 good ones. And I really took it to heart. We're all going to fail. We're all going to make decisions that we shouldn't have made. And we're all going to have to pick ourselves up and face the consequences and move forward. It's a natural part of life. There's just no guarantees. You know that well.
All too well. So fail fast is another phrase that people say.
Well, I guess my issue with that phrase,
ooh, there we go,
is that it presumes you're failing on purpose and fail fast. So do whatever you can. And if you're going to fail, fail fast sounds to me like a purposeful. And I think certainly my starting point is we all get up every morning wanting to do well, if not the best we can, we want to be good people. And we fail because of 100 reasons. So it doesn't resonate with me.
So fast decision-making, that's better.
That works, sure.
Because fail, you put fail fast, fail, it's a negative, and you're saying to do something fast. Let me ask you this. How is being a woman in this industry, going through that time frame, how has that impacted you?
So let me give you a couple different answers and you can edit out whatever you want. So I'd say there's one lens on my career. What was the impact of my being a woman? And that is it blocked me at several locations so that I actually had a career I never imagined. So when I was 16, I wanted to be a vet. I had horses, dogs, cats, chickens, blah, blah, blah. And I got told by a very good friend of my father's that I needed to give that up immediately. And I believed him. He was a vet. I believed him. So shame on me in reflection, but I did. So that then set me on a course to get, I fell in love with economics and got out of undergraduate, really excited about an economic career, financial services career. And financial institution after financial institution said to me, we're not going to hire you for our management training program. It's a two-year program. You're going to get married and have babies and drop out of the workforce. We're not going to invest in you. Right? Early 70s, you got to say that. So I went, oh, shoot. What am I going to do? And that's when I've worked for a couple of years after undergrad, but not in real jobs because I couldn't get a job in my field. And I followed my aunt to law school because I knew that I could, as she had in the 60s, because she couldn't get a job in a firm. She just hung out her shingle and she was self-sufficient. So that's what got me to law school. Yeah. So on reflection, all in good service to me in my career at the time, really hard.
How would you view your career when you look back on it? Is it zigzag? Was it, you know what, Gary, overall, it was a pretty straight line all the way through. What's your perspective?
It was emergent. I didn't set my sights on.
Got a curveball. Emergent. Oof. Wasn't expecting that.
Let me try that again. It was emergent in the sense that I have many colleagues and friends who said, I'm going to be a CEO or I'm going to be a senior executive and I'm going to work that path and get there. For me, I didn't really set that goal. At some point in my career with a particularly bad boss, I thought, oh, if I ever get to run a company, I'm not going to do that. But I didn't set out to be CEO in my 30s. I didn't set out to have a specialty of changing print companies to information companies. I lost a scholarship when I transferred law schools. I needed a job. I didn't like law practice. I had a familiar job that I'd really loved, so I went back to it. Yeah, so straight line, did I consistently get promoted and moved up? Yes. So straight line in that respect, but straight line to me implies 5-year goals, 3-year goals, working hard to get there. No, I was just doing what I loved and trying to deliver results and really be in service to the customers that we were creating product for.
What's been your best career decision?
Executive coaching.
What are you doing today?
Well, that's such a great question because for the first time since I was 16 in December, so what, 10 months ago, I stepped back from full-time work. So it's been 50-some years of full-time work.
Why did you step back? What happened?
Well, because I was a doctoral student finishing my thesis in London, great companion during COVID, trying to submit it last fall, which would have been, you know, late autumn of 2020. And I knew if I didn't know what I was going to do with all my time, because that was a pretty big job for 5 years on top of full-time work. If I didn't know what I was going to do when I finished it, I'd never submit. So I spent a couple of months while I was finishing it, getting close to finishing it, doing a vision board. vision board like you may have done as part of the Hudson program. Half my dining room table, six big panels. And for the first time, what emerged, a beautiful vision board. And what emerged, because I've done them 100 times before, what emerged is work was 1/6 of the vision board. It had never been that small a part of what was drawing me in life. And I think part of it is age. I think part of it is COVID. I think part of it is where I am in this point in my life. But I have a real calling to play, to be adventurous, to explore, to engage with people in different ways, to spend a lot more time. I have 28 young people in my life who really matter to me, to spend time with them. And so what emerged out of this vision board was, doesn't look like I can work full time and do all this.
It can happen.
Exactly.
What's the best advice you've ever gotten?
I think the best advice I've ever gotten came from, I'm sure you've heard of Brené Brown, who's done a lot of shame, resilience, and vulnerability work. And I was trained and certified in her work very early on in her program. And she had a lot of influence on me in terms of, at that stage in my life, revisiting my history from a lens of shame and shame resilience, and really making sense out of where was that keeping me small? Where was that limiting me? Where had that impacted being publisher at the LA Times or not getting a job in a financial services industry or whatever the example is. And so it wasn't advice as in don't do this, but it was this whole opening of, wow, shame really has a huge impact on us and building shame resilience. And so I've ended up retelling most of my life from a very different lens and can see myself in a very different way. So it came after the Hudson self-discovery work and really went hand in glove with that.
What advice do you give most often?
Depends on the age group. But if you think about young people, for example, because you have to have a college degree today. You have to. Doesn't matter if we believe it's a legitimate requirement, you have to. So that's one. Second one is nothing's permanent. If you take a job, you're not signing up for life anymore. Third one is work hard and be nice. Yeah, it is. It is. But as people get older, I don't give advice very much because what I've found, of course, as a result of my coaching career, is sitting with people and really exploring with them what they're yearning for, what they're noticing, opens a world to them that I could never have. So I give less and less advice, actually.
Spoken like a true executive coach. Final question before we get into the fun stuff. What are you most proud of?
Most proud of in my life is my relationship with my family and friends.
That's the 28?
Well, 28 young people. Those are grandkids, great-grandkids, nieces, nephews, their partners, their kids, all that. But that relationship, those relationships were so infused with my training at Hudson because I went from telling them what they should do to being the keeper of their secrets. So I have this safe, gorgeous relationship with these young people who really matter to me. Most proud of in my career, giving back by sharing my doctoral research right now. I think that what I did in this research program and the offering, the invitation for coaches to come and supervisors to come and just consider their own work and reflect on it from whatever I share that provokes or resonates with them is going to have a significant impact on our fields, our professional fields. And that just feels right now so important.
That's impactful. So with 28 young ones, what does Christmas look like around your house?
Well, pre-COVID or post-COVID?
Just if it's pre or post, how many gifts have to go out? And we have a lot of shipping concerns these days. Do you have time for some fun questions? Favorite movie or book?
Poisonwood Bible is my favorite book. It continues to mess with my mind. It's told from 5 different voices. And I just love the way that it's told. And then anything by Anne Lamott.
Anne Lamott, duly noted. What's your favorite meal?
Favorite meal? Oh, that's so easy. So easy. Fabulous, beautiful, fresh salad of herbs and little tomatoes and a little blue cheese. And then three or four gorgeous vegetables and some kind of nice protein, whatever it is. And then for dessert, perfect, perfect raspberries and peaches.
Okay, that has to be one of my least favorite meals I've ever heard. You can dress up all those words and salad with those nice words, but I don't know. That's a tough one. Coming from a guy whose favorite meal is a ribeye, I think this is the polar exactly. opposite. I might have that for my rabbit sitting at my feet while I'm eating my steak. Favorite vacation spot?
Well, you know, that is a really cool question because I have never wanted to have a vacation spot that I always go to. What I love is every new place I go, it just opens up something in me. So if I were to pick someplace I'd go back to, it would be the Amalfi Coast and particularly Positano. But it's not on my next 10 trips list because I've never been to Tuscany. I haven't been to Australia. I haven't been to Vietnam. I haven't been to Fiji. I haven't been to Bali. They're just.
So that's a nuance to the vacation spot. It's the place I haven't been to.
Yeah.
The new place for me to explore. So you're an adventurer.
I like that. I like that a lot. So many places I want to go.
All right. Three-part question. If I gave you $100, $1,000, and $100,000 to spend, what would you buy? Can't invest it. $100, what would you buy?
Same answer, no matter what the amount.
Salad?
No. I'd take it to the food bank.
Okay. So you're going to donate it?
Yeah.
Oh, well done. Any music concert, any artist dead or alive, who do you want to see?
Lady Gaga at the Hollywood Bowl.
So that's, you can probably do that, I imagine. And you've done that?
No, I haven't done it yet.
Okay, so that's probably on your bucket list, if you have a bucket list. I think you answered this. What did you want to be when you grew up? Was it the veterinarian?
I wanted to be a vet, and then I wanted to be an economist, and then I wanted to be a lawyer, and then I became a publishing person. And now I'm a coach and supervisor. It's perfect.
Yeah, it all makes sense. There you go. Yep. Okay, some rapid fire questions. Do you have a go-to fast food restaurant?
I don't eat fast food. Ugh.
Pizza, what kind?
Gluten-free crust, no cheese.
Is that even, that's called bread. Okay, I got news for you. Favorite pizza, bread. Do you have a favorite TV show?
I don't watch TV.
This is going well. Do you have a favorite podcast?
Yours, of course.
That's the right answer. One for the good guy. What is your favorite month of the year?
March.
Why?
It's my birthday month. I celebrate the whole month. And the camellias are out. The tulips are out.
31 days. That's a long month. That's always the question of why. And it's always somebody's birthday month, 9 times out of 10. Do you have a go-to alcoholic beverage?
Yes.
Thank God. What is it?
Wine, red or white, and spicy, hot, spicy margaritas.
Okay. Finally, a good answer. It took a while on the rapid fire, but we finally got one. So any varietal, red or white, doesn't matter.
Well, it matters a lot because I live in wine country. So yeah, it matters a lot.
So the red is?
Red is Zins, I love a lot. Merlots, no Pinot for me. I'm not a Pinot person.
Interesting.
I love blends. Marjoram has a beautiful couple of blends that I really love. And on the white side, Sauvignons, steel, oak, or steel without oak, Chardonnays, Sancerre, of course. Sancerre, of course.
Goes without saying. Come on. I don't know. Are you a cat or a dog person?
Yes.
Both. That's a good answer.
But for many years, I've only had dogs. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your favorite holiday?
Thanksgiving. Love Thanksgiving.
That's the right answer. Why do you like it so much?
It's all about gathering, being with and eating. And food is one of my love languages. I want to gather people all around, set a beautiful table, feed them really yummy stuff.
So do you cook when you have people over?
Always. Yeah.
Holy. What's the biggest gathering you've had at Thanksgiving? How many people?
Oh, at Thanksgiving? I don't know. 30, maybe.
35. And you cook for 30 people. Get sure. out of here.
Sure.
What are you saying like that? You have two kitchens?
No, but it's not hard. It's not hard. Now, A lot of the pies are at room temperature, and some of the veggies, like the grilled or roasted veggies, are at room temperature. And yeah, but oh, I love to feed people. I love it.
Let's be clear, it's more than just salad, right?
Oh yeah, no, it's beautiful turkey and salmon. If you have that many people, it's two different kinds of entrees, and it's the regular pies and the gluten-free pies and all the really, and it always starts with soup because I love soup. And yeah.
Me too. What's your favorite soup?
Butternut squash apple, probably.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds complicated. I don't think I've ever had it, but there you go. Morning or an evening person?
Oh, morning.
Yeah. That is the right answer. What is your first car?
Oh, my first car.
Yeah.
Was pumpkin orange, because I love pumpkins. Pumpkin orange, black racing stripes, opal, a little opal hatchback. That was my first car. I went from that to an MGB.
Tiny.
And then back to a Honda Civic. Yeah.
There you go. Do you have a dream car?
My current car, I love. My current car is a 2014, and I can't imagine giving it up anytime soon. It's just a little Lexus RX 350.
You seem like a person that names your cars. Do you have a name for your car?
I don't.
Okay. I was close though, right?
But I keep a friend's car in the other side of my garage.
Yeah.
And his car's name is Domino. So there's one named car in the household, but it's not mine.
Let's hope that car doesn't fall over. It'll crush yours.
Yeah.
Good one. How many languages do you speak?
One well.
How many poorly?
I can futz around a little bit in Spanish and French, but not very much. Yeah.
Any broken bones?
Yeah. Funny question. So I've broken 3 bones in my life. An arm when I got thrown from one of my horses. My bone in my right foot twice, 9 months apart, same bone. And then I'm just now recovering from a broken hand.
Getting thrown off a horse, that's serious business.
Yeah.
Very dangerous business.
Well, I don't know. I was a young kid and I had 3 horses and I jumped on one in the field bareback, and one of the others got jealous and went to nip that one. And so I got thrown.
Oh, there you go. Don't play favorites.
Made sense at the time to me, not so much when I was in ER.
Would you rather be a bird or a fish?
That is a hard one because I'm a water person. So
I know.
Immediately say fish, except I love to soar. Yeah, so both. How's that?
It's a cop out. Okay, the cat and dog, that's not a cop out, but bird or fish, we might come back to that. Do you have a celebrity crush?
I've had several. Well, the most enduring one is Robert Redford.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Butch and Sundance. Are you kidding me? Not Paul Newman. You were more of a Robert Redford.
Yeah.
Fair enough. You said you had several. Give me one more. Maybe somebody that's less than 80.
Slightly less than 80. George Clooney.
That's the right answer, I think. Yeah. He's a good looking guy. And I just listened to him on a podcast and he sounds like just such a good guy. Do you have a fantasy career? Like you'd be great at it. Anything. What would you want to be?
I'm doing it. All right. So you want a different answer. All right. Here's my fantasy career.
Reading body language.
Here's my fantasy career. Yeah. So I would love to have a little bakery where I got to make coffee and teas and fresh pastries and sweets and omelets and goat cheese salads and whatever for my friends and neighbors.
Your favorite smell of these three? Coffee, popcorn, or bacon?
Oh, popcorn.
Hands down. Final rapid fire question. First thing you mentioned in the podcast was being financially independent. Have you reached that goal?
Yep.
Well done. Dinner with anybody, dead or alive?
You know who I want to have dinner with so much is my mom. Because I didn't know her as a human, right? She did a lot of crappy things as a mom. She did a lot of good things as a mom. But I would like, and I know bits and pieces of her history, but I would like to sit and really understand her life. And she died very young and very angry about dying young. And I'd really love to have that kind of conversation with her.
That is a good one. Final question. How do you want to be remembered?
Kind, giving, warm, loving, generous, grateful.
Well, if I surveyed the 28 young people, my guess is they would tick all those boxes. What is F all of the above? That would be my guess. So if you give me all their emails, I'll send that out. I'll take care of that for you. But chances are, I'm sure you're meeting that. If you give these salads and goat cheese to everybody, it'll even go higher up on the list, right? St. Catherine, she fed me. It's the best thing ever. Anyway, thank you so, so much for being on. I had a great time talking with you. Thanks for your honesty and your openness. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Gary. It was great to be with you. Thanks for the chance to just go down memory lane. It was fun.